This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. In the U.S. justice system, there are adult criminal courts and there's one for juveniles. Children are considered not entirely responsible for their actions and because they can still be rehabilitated. That's the idea. That's a philosophy that we have in America. But what is a juvenile? If a child commits an adult crime like murder, does that juvenile suddenly become an adult in the eyes of the law? And then what is that process? Is that process thoughtful and purposeful, or is it just a boilerplate sort of an action, a knee-jerk action? That's an issue that was raised recently on a story aired on the Texas Standard as it explored one case and looked at the broader picture as well about how we bring juveniles into the adult criminal system and how they serve adult time as well in the penal system. We're joined by Hannah McBride and Alon Stevens, reporting partners for the Texas Standard. They did that story. And also with us is Clayton Matheson. He is a San Antonio-based attorney. Matheson is also featured in that story. And welcome to The Source, all y'all. Appreciate y'all being here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Alon, let me ask you if you could sort of set the stage here. You feature Miguel Navarro. So talk about him and what happened to him.
So Miguel Navarro was this 15-year-old who followed his 17-year-old older brother to a high school party back in 2007. And, you know, they went to this party, and it was just like any high school party, almost out of a TV show. You have people drinking and doing drugs, and at one point in the party, a fight broke out, and they asked Miguel and his older brother to leave, and during the midst of this fight, Miguel brought out a knife and stabbed three people, and he killed one of them. And he found himself, you know, he comes from a poor family, and he found himself getting a public defender and going into the criminal justice system with a charge of murder. And, you know, they certified him as an adult. And, you know, speaking with Miguel, he really kind of didn't understand what was going on. And they handed him down his sentence, which was 99 years. So we wanted to kind of go back and look at that and the process that got him there. And we found out that this was kind of a normal process. They had kind of expedited the process where they transfer the juvenile to the adult court system. And this had happened to thousands of juveniles in a certain period of time in Texas.
So you're telling two stories. One of them is about this one particular case with Miguel Navarro. And also I want to mention the name of the 20-year-old college student who was murdered. That would be Matthew Haltom and Haltom Jr. And so there's that story. And then there's also the broader picture that we're talking about, the how Texas deals with juveniles who commit serious crimes and how they bring them into the adult system. So Miguel Navarro and his brother are described in the media reports at that time as party crashers, that they were not supposed to be at that party. Is that correct?
Yes. So at the time, you know, we spoke to Lupe and we spoke to Miguel, and you know, we went through tons and tons of case transcripts, and yeah, there were a lot of, you know, conflicting reports here. Lupe and Miguel said that, you know, they in fact were invited by one of the people at the party. The other people, you know, Haltom and his family say that these were uninvited guests. But, you know, when tackling this story, we really didn't want to retry the case.
These details are significant. If you're trying you're trying to draw a picture of Miguel in a sympathetic light, then people who are trying to figure this out, they should know. I mean, was he just suddenly doing something way out of character and he's actually a really great guy, or did he have a history of violence?
So he did. He did have a history. You know, he was on probation and he had gotten into fights before. Going back and looking at both sides of it, you know, we looked into Haltom's side as well, and there was drug use involved. And so when we see kind of Miguel, he didn't contest really at all that he committed this crime. When we immediately sat down with him, he said, you know, I was there, I brought out the knife, I stabbed him, and I have no clue why I did that. And the real question kind of became, you know, well, okay, during the certification process, when they tried you as an adult, what factors did they take into account? And we went over those forms, we found that none of those details were really there, that they did it, it was very scant. And so it kind of raised this question of, you know, should we be trying juveniles as adults with these forms that really we can't go back and see what the judge's rationale was for making that decision?
Right, and that's important. That's really where we're trying to get at. I just wanted to establish, particularly, you know, always remember the victim is something that I've been taught in doing these types of stories about murders and talking about people who are, you know, doing a lot of time in prison for murder. You always think who got killed and who is this person, and not to just glance over them. So let me ask, you know, our other reporter who's involved in this story, you know, Hannah, talk about, you know, your experience doing this story. What did you discover?
Right. So after we had met Clayton, the lawyer, and been able to go to prison and meet Miguel, we realized that, yes, someone, in this case Miguel, did something wrong. But we wanted to look more at the process of how many kids fall into this boat. He was a kid who had a history of fights at school, and he had been on probation for a fight on a school bus at the time that this had happened. And we wanted to look at, if a kid makes a mistake at a party and he's sentenced to something like 99 years, does he ever get a second chance? Is that throwing away two lives? We definitely feel deeply sorry about the loss of Matthew Haltom's life as people. But as reporters, we wanted to look at, is this something that has happened more than once? And so we did some digging. There's no state-level data that's compiled in a single place in the adult system of what happens to kids who are tried as adults. But the juvenile system, the Texas Juvenile Justice Department, keeps track of how many kids are certified year by year. And we saw this time period between the 1995 and 2015. 1995 is when the law changed, and kids did not get a chance to appeal their decision at the juvenile court level of being certified. So they basically never got a second chance to be seen as children. Once they're considered an adult, they're considered an adult, and there's no other way to rectify that. And we saw in that 20-year period, 5,200 kids had been certified. And, you know, over that period of time, that's 5 kids a week for 2 decades. Like, that is a lot of children who don't get another chance to be seen in the eyes of the court as a child. And that is why Miguel's story became so important to us, because he is, through the appeal that Clayton, his lawyer, is spearheading, he is getting that second chance for a reassessment of his sentencing.
Okay, and we're going to talk about that. We got to take a quick break. It's a 1-minute break, and we'll be right back. The number to call in if you got a question or a comment is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Should children do adult time for adult crime? This is The Source. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. It's a principle of American justice that juveniles who commit crimes should have their day in juvenile court. They should not be brought into the adult courts, because that's for people who are, you know, more responsible, and they're less and seen less likely in order to be rehabilitated. So, but why are we bringing over 500 children into the adult court system over the last 20 years? We're talking about that. We're looking at a story that was reported on the Texas Standard recently. The two reporters, Alon Stevens and Hannah McBride, also with us in the studio to talk about is Clayton Matheson. He's the attorney representing Miguel Navarro and his appeal. So let me bring you into this, Miguel, Clayton, since you're the attorney. What happens? How does this happen? What is the process that a child can be brought into the adult courts?
So the juvenile court holds what is called a certification hearing, in which the prosecutor and the defendant, the juvenile defendant, both present evidence. They call witnesses. maybe psychiatrists, people from within the criminal justice system that have worked with the individual or have come across the individual, maybe police officers, friends, family, perhaps. There is a process by which the juvenile court, who in this case is sitting as both judge and jury, decides if the particular individual minor deserves to go to adult court, number one, and then number two, that he the individual fits the statutory criteria that would allow him to go to adult court. So there is a hearing process, but at the end of the day, and to be clear, that hearing took place in Miguel's case. I'm not here to say that Miguel did not get his day in court necessarily. I'm here to say that the focus is on what the results of that certification hearing, which is what's called a transfer order. It is, in my mind, one of the most powerful documents out there because it is the piece of paper that literally will send a kid to adult court, where that kid will then be subject to the adult criminal laws, including the penalties that are available under the adult criminal laws, and the prospect of serving time in an adult prison facility. So that order, you know, in a civil case, I'm a civil litigator. When we get an important decision or important order or a summary judgment ruling, you better believe that the judge puts his explanation on paper. He explains his reasons. He discusses the facts. He talks about the competing facts, and he weighs them, and he explains why he came down on one side or the other of the fence. Well, unfortunately, in the juvenile certification context, juvenile courts just have not done that, and instead have used what essentially are boilerplate forms that contain, in Miguel's case, it contained his name, his age, and the most rudimentary facts about the crimes that with which he was tried and convicted, or with which he was charged. That's it. There is not a single fact about who he is as a person, nothing about his background, nothing about the incident that led to his arrest. So, you know, all these things that people might be saying about the underlying trial, about Miguel and his history of violence, none of that was in this piece of paper that, you know, by itself took him from possibly serving a 40-year sentence under the juvenile laws to serving, you know, frankly, fortunately, it was only 99 years because it could have been worse.
How could it have been worse?
Well, as an adult, he would have been eligible for the death penalty.
Well, you can't give someone the death penalty if they committed the crime under the age of 18.
Well, then you know more than me. And to be clear to the audience, I am not a criminal lawyer. This case is my first foray into this field. I do commercial litigation. So then 99 years would have been the maximum.
So the Supreme Court has ruled that juveniles are not eligible to receive the death penalty. And the Supreme Court has also ruled that juveniles are not supposed to receive life in prison without parole. And so I'm wondering, like, what is the difference between giving a juvenile 99 years and or is that just semantics trying to get around the Supreme Court's ruling that you don't give life without parole to juveniles?
Well, that's exactly right. And you're referring, there's a Supreme Court case within the last 6 months, I believe, that said that. And our argument would be, and by the way, we also have an alternative proceeding going on in federal court right now. It's being stayed pending resolution of this certification issue. But we are arguing in federal court that a 99-year sentence for a child is a de facto life sentence and therefore unconstitutional as well. Now, technically, Miguel would be eligible for parole. I can't remember. Again, I don't do this. I think it's 45 years would be when he's first eligible for parole. But it's my understanding that you rarely get out on the first time. And then they don't reassess you for parole, but every 5 years. So in my mind, if you're going in as a 17-year-old is when he was tried and convicted, the earliest you're going to get out, you're in your 70s. So to me, that is a de facto life sentence.
Our phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980. If you want to join our conversation as we talk about adult crime and adult time and how the criminal courts transfer juveniles into the adult system here in Texas. Brandon is on the line. Brandon, hi. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi. This is awesome. This is the first time doing this, so I'm kind of excited.
Okay, well, go right ahead, sir.
So my question is that it seems like in Miguel's case and possibly these other cases, we're supposing that the certification transcripts that were are in some way white, like just pencil-whipped or invalid. I guess my question is, why are we supposing automatically that the courts aren't doing their jobs? And, you know, if you've got the actus reus there and then the men's, you know, you kind of have that mentality of, yeah, the guy did it, and he also understands that that was the outcome of this action of stabbing somebody, then why don't we just trust the lower courts, as much? And I'm always about making things better, but.
Okay. All right. So, Hannah, you want to answer that?
Sure. Yeah, it's a good question. And I think at the heart of Miguel's case in particular and at the heart of his appeal is a decision made by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals, the highest criminal court in the state, in December 2014 in the case of Cameron Moon. And they said these transfer orders, the boilerplate forms that Clayton was referring to, do not show their work. That's the term that was in the court opinion. And that is at the heart of Miguel's case as well. They basically say the most detailed information is name, birth date, charge, and location. In Miguel's case, they say that he used a knife. In Cameron Moon's case, they didn't indicate murder weapon. And we're basically saying that in this case, the same thing happened. And that's the core of Clayton's argument. The lower courts are not telling the higher courts, this is how we came to this conclusion. They're just simply saying we came to this conclusion. And that's at the case of this, that's at the heart of this appeal. And I think it's a good point. The lower courts are already going through this whole process. Miguel had a hearing. Miguel had 5 days of people on both sides coming to talk about him, his history, what had happened that night. But we don't have any of that. If we look at the 8-page form, a lot of it is language pulled directly from the Texas Family Code, where it says you must consider X, Y, and Z. And then the form says we considered X, Y, and Z. It doesn't say how, doesn't say what, doesn't say who they heard from and how they came to that conclusion. And the opinion in the Moon case says we don't want to armchair quarterback, essentially. We don't want to suppose how you came to this conclusion. We don't want to do this work over. Let's have it all written out in black and white the first time. And that's what's happening here. Now, juveniles do have that option. They do have judges at the juvenile level describing why people are certified. But Miguel fell into this gap between 1995 and the end of 2014, where there is no work shown. And that's why his case is currently pending appeal.
So Brandon brings up an interesting point, though, about the courts and how they operate and the manner of trust that we should have in them. We know that judges and prosecutors are under a lot of pressure and people and that public oversight is an important part of the legal process. Clayton, do you want to add to that?
Yeah. And you know, I certainly am not here to argue or in any way suggest that our juvenile judges in this state are not doing their work. I probably would jump to assume that they are. And in full disclosure, I have a family member who's a juvenile judge, and I know very well that he takes his job extremely seriously and does everything that he needs to do the way he needs to do it. But at the end of the day, this decision, again, I can't imagine many more decisions that are more important and more impactful than sending a kid to adult court. It is too important to assume that the judge was doing it correctly. And I'll add that the burden to satisfy Moon, at least in my mind, is not that severe. We're talking about, you know, attaching to, you could even use the boilerplate form, but attach to it, you know, proposed findings. 4, 5, 6 pages might do the job. We're not talking about writing, you know, a book. At the end of the day, the stakes are too high. I totally get courts are busy. They have limited resources, but it's just too important.
Another caller, Christopher. Hey, Christopher, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Go ahead.
My question is, has anybody talked to Matthew Halton's family to see what his opinion would be of their son's murderer getting early release?
So go ahead.
Well, I want to clarify that, you know, the end result here is not an early release necessarily. Even if we prevail on this Moon issue, and as was explained in the article, Miguel would be subject in almost almost certainly will be recertified or attempted to be recertified and retried. You know, for practical reasons, the DA might choose to enter some sort of a plea agreement. I'm not a criminal lawyer. I don't know. But we're not talking about Miguel walking next month by any means.
Right, but the Christopher asked a direct question. So, Alon, can you answer that?
Yeah, so we actually did get some feedback from Halton's parents here. And, you know, to be honest, they are very upset and very concerned about Miguel leaving and getting off. And, you know, and they do have a legitimate concern. And when we look at these types of documents like we were looking at, we have to see that these certifications can work both ways, you know. The details do also establish why a judge made that decision. And if that is a good decision, victims rely on that for instances just like this to make sure that, you know, someone doesn't walk. And going back, we want to make sure that notes are being taken and proper procedures are being done so we don't have, you know, people coming in later on and walking because there's a lack of details, there's a lack of evidence, and a lack of proper steps taken. And you know, if Miguel's case is heard, we will definitely be in contact with Halton's family to get their opinion on it because, you know, as you said, yes, we are concerned about, you know, we do have a criminal justice system here with a lot of people in it. And, yes, some of these people cannot be rehabilitated. But we have to make sure that due diligence is done and that the notes and evidence are there. So when we look back at it 10 years down the line, we know what decisions to make.
Right. And one of the more troubling things about the story that I saw was that how difficult it was for you to gather the data that you needed to in order to establish how frequently these boilerplates are used to bring people into children into the adult system. At very least, we need to have at least some sort of tracking mechanism for that. Thank all of our guests, Clayton Matheson, he's a San Antonio-based attorney, Hannah McBride, and Alon Stevens, reporters at the Texas Standard. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.